Okay. Day four, is it, of Sesshin? Time flies. So since we have a few new people here, I just like to briefly go over again the purpose of koan. What's the purpose of a koan? And actually, you know, there's many, many definitions of what a koan is, but the purpose of a koan is to untangle us. To untangle us from the hold that words, you know, have on us. Words really have a hold on us. They're like barriers. To me, that's one of the purposes of a koan, is to free ourselves from this entanglement. In fact, there is one koan collection which is attributed to Dogen, called the Dogen 300 koans, which is a mixture of all of our koans as well. There's a few new ones in there, but most of them are already the koans that we deal with. It's called Untangling Vines. That's a lovely description. It's just it's like we're going into this jungle of a koan. We've got to untangle it, make it clear, you know. And this one is a beauty. We're going to go really into a jungle here because there's so many words. Actually, the koan itself is very direct. But in this particular case, we're going to deal with the Denko Roku. So this is the book, Transmission of Light, the Denko Roku. And Denko Roku was compiled by Master Kaizen, a Japanese master, second in succession of Dogen. Kaizen lived, he was born in 1268. Okay. And he was born in a time when there was much upheaval in Japan, to the point where the Soto lineage, which was founded by Dogen in Japan and Tozen in China, was almost at the point of imploding because of internal infights, disagreements, and also because somehow it didn't align with the politics of the day. And Kaizen is credited for putting an end to this infighting and also for reestablishing the authority of the Soto lineage as an institution in Japan, as a Buddhist institution in Japan. Because you couldn't just say, okay, in those days, you needed to have the authority of the state, same as in China, in order to have, you know, to have a religion, or in order to practice a religion. So the way he did this is he needed to somehow prove that it was legitimate. And what he did is he traced the Kensho experiences or enlightenment experiences all the way from Shakyamuni Buddha to Dogen, and actually another one after Dogen, I think it was, up to himself, but he didn't include himself in that lineage. And he said, that is the authority of the Soto line. That is the authority of Buddhism. It is not what people that had it wrote, including the Buddha, because that points to it. It's actually what is it that they have experienced. That is the authority. So he traced it all back from Shakyamuni, all the first 28 patriarchs to Bodhidharma, who then came to China, then all the other patriarchs that came up to Dogen. He went to China, and then the patriarchs from Dogen, which were only two, to Japan. And here we are. This lineage continues. So in many ways, if you like, it's a spiritual genealogy. This book is a spiritual genealogy, not like a bloodline. For those of us that are practicing Zen, this is our family. In a spiritual sense, these are our ancestors that are in here. And so each of those experiences that each master had are documented in this book. and they formed a case. Then Kaizen wrote a verse, in other words, his take on it, which are absolutely classics. But not only that, he wrote a background about every teacher. How did they grow up? All sorts of funny things as far as the background is concerned, especially going back into Indian time. And then on top of that, he wrote also a Teisho. So when we study this book, or when we study this collection of koans, we obviously don't study the whole thing. It would be too much, you know. We only study the case itself, and we study we introspect, if you like, the verse. So the idea there is that the student needs to see exactly what the master has seen. You know, that's the task. When you go into the Dokusan room, you need to present what has the master seen. You need to be able to see that, you know. And you need to show that, you know, because words, they don't they deceive us. Remember, untangling vines. Is that the words have such a hold on us. The reason we don't understand a koan is because the words trip us over and over and over again. They trip us up. That's why we don't understand a koan. So we need to somehow break through. What is it here that is really it? What is the light? He called this the transmission of light. So the transmission of light is like, that is what is being transmitted. Scott yesterday talked about the light. They're not words that are being transmitted. It's not doctrine that is being transmitted. It's transmission of the light, seeing the light, seeing what the others have seen. Okay, that is what is being transmitted in this. So the koan that. The koan that we have today is about Master Tozen. Okay. So Tozen is the founder of the Soto school. So it's actually a really, really important master for us because he founded our school. So when I say he founded our school, as Scott mentioned yesterday, there are two schools left. Originally, there were five schools, so you've got five different colors here. These are the different schools, and they're the founders and the masters during this Tang Dynasty period. That this is the succession line, if you like. But today, there are only two left, so Soto and Rinzai. And our lineage is a hybrid, if you like, between Soto and Rinzai, because we follow the Soto line. You know, our lineage takes Dogen as its founder, if you like. But at the same time, we also follow the koan work. We also do the koan work, which Haku Nigaku has revived, certainly in Japan, and that's what we follow. So we fall into those two, you know, as a hybrid line. But the alignment is definitely more Soto. So Tozen, he's also called Dongshan in China. Sorry, he's also called, where is he? In China, in yes, Dongshan. So Dongshan, so that first one here, Dongshan, you see that? The first pink right on top, there you have Tozen. So first the Chinese name, Dongshan, then Tozen. Then you have his birth date, 807 to 869. And you can straight away look up and see who his teacher was. Okay, so there you got Ungan as his teacher, and he'll come up as well. And so you see Ungan there as his teacher, and then Tozen. And then you see his successors underneath. And by the way, that lineage, as it is here, continues to this day. That lineage is being updated on a continuous basis. And guess who updates it? ANU, Australian National University. They are the ones that are updating it. There's a guy there called Matthew Siulek. And if you look it up, it goes all the way down to where we are right here. You know, and he's been updating all the lineages. It's quite interesting that it happens to be in Australia, but that's where that lineage is being updated. So I hope it continues even after Matthew. I don't know how old Matthew is, but I hope it does continue. It's very interesting. Okay, so I'd just like to now read the case. So case 38, so it's the 38th patriarch, Denkoroku, the 38th patriarch, Tozen Gohon Daishi. The 38th patriarch, Tozen Gohon Daishi, came to Ungan. He asked, "Who can hear the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings?" Ungan said, "The Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings can be heard by the non-sentient beings." The master said, so this is Tozan, so Tozan said, "Do you, master," meaning Ungan, "do you, Ungan, hear it or not?" Ungan said, "If I can hear it, you cannot hear my Dharma preaching." Tozan said, "If that is so, Ryokai, which is I, then I will not hear the Dharma preaching of Ungan, of the master." Ungan said, "You don't even hear my Dharma preaching. How would you hear the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings?" And with these words, the master came to great enlightenment. And he composed a poem and offered it to Ungan. "How marvelous, how marvelous. The Dharma preaching of the non-sentient being is miraculous. If you hear it with the ears, it would be impossible to understand it after all. Only when you hear the voice with the eyes will you be able to know it." So the challenge now, of course, is to see what he has seen. What has Tozen seen in this? So let's unpack this and go through it. First of all, the 38th patriarch Tozen Gohon Daishi, he came to Ungan. So Ungan, as I already said, was his teacher. He asked, "Who can hear the Dharma preaching?" Want to make a point too. It's interesting to look at Dharma from two perspectives. Dharma, of course, is in many, many traditions. In the Hindu tradition, even the Upanishads, it's already mentioned. So Dharma is a word, a Sanskrit word, Dhamma in Pali. Dharma in Sanskrit, that is generally known. Okay. And it's known as the teaching. So most people understand Dharma as the teachings. Okay, but Dharma has many, many other meanings as well. And Dharma with a capital D usually refers to the way it is, or right view. It's that supramundane perspective, that ultimate perspective. So when you see Dharma with a capital D, it usually refers to the Dharma as in what the Dharma lowercase points to. So there's almost that which is written, but whatever is written points to something. And Dharma capital D is what it is. Please make that distinction. Now, not everyone knows that, and that is why quite often you see Dharma with a capital D, but it's not actually, it actually refers to Dharma with a lowercase D. But that is really the way it's like right view. It's like the mundane and the supramundane. You can look at right view from these two perspectives, from the ordinary perspective, dualistic perspective, samsaric perspective. Or you can look at it from the nirvanic perspective or non-dual perspective, same sort of thing. So that's how we distinguish between the two. Okay. So here, we have capital D. So the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings can be heard by the non-sentient beings. Okay. So that's the first thing. So then he said, "Who can hear the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings?" That's the point of the whole koan. So you can see there's quite a few pages there. But the whole point of the koan is, who can hear the Dharma preachings of the non-sentient beings? So in order to find out, who can hear the Dharma preachings of the non-sentient beings. The first thing we've got to do is discover or to find out what is non-sentient beings, you know. So there's a footnote here, so maybe we'll get a clue there. So the footnote says, beings without feelings or consciousness, such as mountains, rivers, grass, trees, and stones. Well, that's a typical example of non-sentient beings, okay? But how can they preach? They've got no feelings, they've got no voice, they've got no, they've got no no cognition, you know. How can they preach? So there's our first barrier, if you like. You know, and if we don't get past that barrier, the whole thing will not make sense, you know. And that is why also we start koans proper only once you've had an experience where you've passed that barrier. Because before you've had some sort of an experience, it might make intellectual sense to some degree of what is being meant here and what I'm talking about here in the Teisho. But it isn't yet at the depth that this is talking about. So that is why, in our lineage anyway, everyone starts on Mu, and you stay on Mu until you've had an opening that gives you insight into this world of non-sentient beings, or preaching, or whatever point is addressed in a particular koan. Okay. So I'd like to just talk about something else, and that is something that we teach in prison, and it might start making maybe hopefully a little bit of sense and trigger something. So in prison we have this module called conflict resolution, or just how to deal with conflict. Okay. So there's an example there, and it's called the ladder of inference. The ladder of inference. Okay, so one thing leading to another is inference. You know, it's like when I say something, you might infer something else of what I said. So there's one thing that leads to another. That's inference. So imagine a ladder with rungs. Okay, and so this concept was developed by some psychologist. I forget the name now. And it starts off with, the example is giving that there is someone laying in a ditch that is all bloody, okay? And someone just happens in an alleyway, and it's a bit dark, and you see this person laying there that's all bloody. So you go there and you see that person. So the first thing we see is someone laying there that is bloody, okay? That's called the fact. That's the fact. Then there's a layer that comes above that, which is what I notice. So I go there and I see this scenario. What is it that I notice? I might see blood, but I might also see his shoes. And because I've been meaning to buy these shoes. So I notice the shoes, you know. Or I might see the curtain twitching and someone watching the whole thing up in the window, you know. So it's actually what I notice, you know, is limited to what I notice. It might be a lot, it might be little, but it may not have anything to do with the fact at all. Okay. So that's the first rung of the ladder, is what I notice. The second rung is I add meaning, you know. I add some sort of a meaning to this whole scenario. Another one might be, I just want to change that around to another situation. I hear a sound. I add meaning. There's a plane. You know. Then after that, I make an assumption. He's left the airport, or he's arriving. You know, I make an assumption. Same thing with that person that is laying there that is bloody. You know, I make an assumption. Oh, he's been robbed, or there's someone out there that caused this. You know, I'm in danger. You know, or I form belief, or the belief might be I'm in danger. I'm in danger. That might be the belief. So that's the next rung. So there's all these rungs that happen cognitively, you know, before it gets to I take action. Okay, And the moral of the story in prison is that this is actually how conflict arises, is that that we have a situation, someone says something to me, and it jumps from the fact to me making a belief that it was good or bad, or that it was aggressive or not aggressive, and that is then me creating the story, and within that story I form beliefs, and then after that I take actions based on the belief, which has might have got nothing to do with the fact at all. And that's what we do. You know. Now, when you look at the fact, and then you look at the next part which are overlays of the fact that we are laying these things over, these concepts over the fact, you know, these are what in Buddhism are called mental formations. That's what they are. They're mental formations, you know. The problem is that is all we do. We live in the world of mental formations. We've forgotten the skill to see the fact. We can all see it, but because we are so much entrenched into mental formations, we don't even know what the fact is anymore. If I say to you, there's a chair, what is the fact of the chair? What's the fact of the chair? Our mind is immediately chair. Chair is already a mental formation. It's a word. It's a chair. I form a belief or I form an assumption. Oh, it's that'll be cold to sit on. Oh, that's hard. I don't want that chair. That's uncomfortable. All this comes in straight away into chair. You know, but what is the fact of the chair? Non-sentient beings are preaching, okay? But we don't see it because we are trapped in our mental formations. Our mental formations, they're there for a purpose, of course, and we need those mental formations to make sense of the world and to live in this world, you know? But it's like someone that is trapped in, I don't know if you've got kids that are trapped in a virtual world. It's the same thing. They're in front of a computer all day long. This is like in another world. We are exactly the same, except that world is in our brain, in our thinking. We have an image of reality that is completely made up, that is completely, first of all, self-referenced all the time. There's me, about everything to do about me, but also not necessarily in a negative way, but how I see the world according to my mental formations. Everything I do is this mental formation, you know. So when we get to these koans are all designed to get out of that and to see the preaching of the non-sentient beings, which, like all these words, is nothing other than our true self. It's nothing other than Buddha, nothing other than oneness, nothing other than allness. Nothing other than whatever label you want to give it. But of course, no matter what label I give it, it's another mental formation. It's not it. That's just a label. That's why we interchange the words all the time. Because don't get stuck on emptiness or nothingness, you know, or allness, you know. These are just labels that designate, and we believe that. We believe that that is so. That is a chair. There's no way that that is not a chair, you know. But that's only because of we've been taught that way, of course. We've been conditioned that way. The only reason that that is a chair is because we're taught that that's a chair. But actually, this is not a chair. This chair is empty of chair. It is an assembly of parts, as I keep on saying, that we label chair. That's why mindfulness is so important. I remember having this really good experience brushing my teeth, and I shared it many times. I thought, okay, I'm going to brush my teeth, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, there's no such thing as brushing the teeth. It's just lifting. It's touching. like, again, of course, these are words I'm using, which is mental formation, so it's the only way I can communicate. There's taking it, there's tasting, there's rubbing. And that whole umbrella term is called brushing my teeth. But there's nothing like it. There is no such thing as brushing your teeth. That's just the word that we use for it. What is brushing teeth? What is chair? At what time is chair no longer a chair? What do I have to do to that chair before I say it's no longer a chair? If I eat a piece of fruit, say, oh, there's a mandarin. I eat that piece of fruit. Where's the mandarin? So really, was there a mandarin? There's a mandarin right there. There's a mandarin right there. I am nothing but mandarins. See the preaching of the non-sentient beings. This is what this is about. What is the preaching of, what is the word here again? What does he say? What's the question? Who can hear the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings? Who can hear it? We're here to hear it. And of course, we need to get out of the way to do that. And by saying we need to get out of the way, we need to get out of our head. We need to let go of our rigidity of thinking, of labeling. That's why we substitute everything with mu to lessen the hold language has on us. Oh, I better go outside. Outside? Where's outside? Where is outside? I better go outside. There's no such thing as outside. I better go inside. Inside? Moo. You know. Lessen the hold that language has on us. This is who can hear the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient being. So the first thing, in order to get this koan, we need to get a sense of what this is, this non-sentient beings. Ungan said, the Dharma preachings of the non-sentient beings can be heard by the non-sentient beings. The Dharma preachings of the non-sentient beings can be heard by the non-sentient beings. I cannot see that if I don't see non-sentient beings. If I can't see that I am nothing but mandarins, I can't see that. If I see that I am nothing but mandarins and cauliflower and whatever we had for soup, beans and that polenta, I think it was, for breakfast. If I can't see that, I cannot see that the preaching cannot be heard by non-sentient beings. I need to hear that very clearly. The master, Tozan, said, do you, master, meaning Ungan, his teacher, do you, master, hear it or not? Do you, master, hear it or not? And Ungan said, if I can hear it, you cannot hear my Dharma preaching. In other words, if I am me, if I am Arno, here I am and there you are, there's no way I can hear it. I need to disappear for that to be heard. I cannot hear it. You cannot hear it. If I can hear it, you cannot hear it. There's no two. Just sentient beings. The master, Tozan, said, if that is so, Ryukai, which is I, which is his first name, Tozan's first name, so the master, Tozan, said, if that is so, Ryukai, in other words, I, will not hear the Dharma preaching of the master, of Ungan. If that is so, then I won't hear it. He is stuck in me and you and cushion and chair and mandarin, and he's stuck in that world of separation, you know. Then I cannot hear it, you know. Ungan said, you don't even hear my Dharma preaching. How would you hear the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings? In other words, you don't even understand what I'm saying, let alone how would you understand this whole, you know, the Dharma preaching of the sentient beings. And that's when he got it. And the master came to great enlightenment. And then he wrote a verse, an enlightenment verse about this. Or when I say an enlightenment verse, he wrote a verse that where he tried to capture what he's seen. Okay. And this is what he wrote. how marvelous the Dharma preaching of the non-sentient beings is miraculous. If you hear it with the ears, it would be impossible to understand it. If you hear it with the ears, it would be impossible to understand it after all. Only when you hear the voice with the eyes will you be able to know it. Only when you hear the voice with the eyes will you be able to know it. So, you know, hearing it with the eyes, you know, you could say, only if the Mandarin can hear it. What is eyes? What is hearing? What is voice? Once the eye dissolves, it becomes clear. Because the eye keeps everything in place, nicely ordered. You're a Mandarin, you're a cushion, you're a chair. And never the twain shall meet. We keep it all ordered. Just like this, very nice, very, very accurate, yes. Has to be like, we keep it all ordered. Okay. So his realization was, only when you hear the voice with the eyes, when you can say that the chair is nothing other than a Mandarin, you know, that's when you will be able to know it. And then Unmon acknowledged him. So he acknowledged that he had seen something. Okay, so then we get to the background. So that was the case. So the background in this case is, yeah, the background of the master, if you like. Now, please don't take everything literally here. As I always say that, especially when it comes to the, you know, from Tozan, there's a lot of written records about Tozan. So and the Chinese kept good records even in the year 800. They were prolific in record keeping. So there's actually documents that we can validate that, you know, came from that era that point to it, and various things can corroborate it. But when it comes down to the first Indian patriarchs, it's very unlikely, you know, that we even know they existed, let alone what experience they had. But nevertheless, you know, it's not about the accuracy; it's the spirit of it. It's the spirit of it. So we take what we've got, and don't take it too literally. Okay, the background. This is interesting, also quite challenging, actually. His background. May cause a few triggers. Trigger warning, as they say nowadays. Okay, background. The master's personal name was Ryukai. He was from Ikai, and his family name was Yu. While still a child, he read the Hanya Shingyo Sutra with a teacher. And when he came to the spot where it said, "There is no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind," he suddenly stroked his face with his hands and asked his teacher, "But I have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. Why does the sutra say that they do not exist?" Of course, we read the Heart Sutra. No body, no eyes, no tongue, no. Why does it say it doesn't exist? Now you need to see that. You know, he was only a little boy and he already had that question, you know. Why does it say that? But there is a nose, that's the nose. You know, there the eyes, right there. Why does it say it doesn't exist? What do you say to a child like that? You know, already at that age, you know, saying that. His teacher was astounded. And seeing that the boy was unusual, he said, "I'm not your teacher," and send him to Master Raimoku. So Raimoku, born 747, died 818, a disciple of great Master Ba, and Sekitso. So Basso, Master Ba is Basso, or Matsu in China, and he was also the teacher of Nansen, and he also was the teacher of Haikujo. So very, very famous master, Master Ba. So he sent him to this great master, okay, to start off with. Okay. So he sent him to Zen Master Raimaku on Mount Goai, where he had his head shaved. In other words, he became he became a monk. So having your head shaved means that you became a monk. Okay. When he was 21, he visited Mount Su, where he was given all the precepts. By the way, that Mount Su, I was found out, is Shaolin Temple. And Shaolin Temple is obviously also where Joshua was. And a lot of these great masters somehow started off or eventually got to Shaolin Temple. And even today, that is a temple that is still, that's been completely renovated, still very much functioning. In fact, one of the Kenshukais, teachers' meetings, was held at Shaolin Temple in China. I wish I would, I wasn't a teacher at the time, but I wish I would have been there. Would have been really, really special to have gone there. And so anyway, this is where he was, and so this is where he went. Okay. Now goes the story. He was his mother's beloved child. His elder brother had died. His younger brother was poor, and his father was long dead. However, once he longed for the gate of emptiness, in other words, the Buddha way, once he longed for this discovering his true self, if you like, he left his old mother for good. He vowed, saying, "If I do not realize the way, I will never come back to my native town, and I will never come to honor my mother." Thus vowing, he left his native town. Subsequently, he completed his learning and later lived on Mount To. By the way, after this, certainly in the Buddhist tradition, he left his mother for good, okay? Even Shakyamuni, of course, left his family as well. And as some people argue, or not argue, but comment on that, is how can you leave your family? You know, how can you leave your family? You know, what a selfish thing to do, you know, to leave your family. So over the years, this has all changed from a monastic tradition. Now, if someone is not of adult age, they need to ask permission. So if you wanted to become a monk or a nun, you cannot go in there unless your parents give you permission. In former times, that wasn't the case. You could just go. But now you need to get permission. It's the same also in the certainly in the Catholic Church that I know of as well. Okay, the mother, it goes on, was left alone by her only son, and no one seemed to be there to take care of her. Day after day, she looked for her son, and in the end, she mingled with beggars and wandered around here and there. When she heard that her son lived on Mount To, she went there with deep longing to see him. But Tozan firmly refused to see her, barring the way to his room so that she could not enter. He did not allow her to see him. Consequently, his mother was chagrined and finally died of grief outside his room. After she died, Tozan personally went to her and found 3 go, it's a measurement of rice, she had collected as a beggar. He took the rice, mixed it with the customary morning gruel, and offered it to the whole assembly of monks. Thus, he made a funeral service in the view of her further journey, to aid her along in a further journey. And not long after, the mother appeared to Tozan in a dream and said, "Because you firmly preserved your resolve and did not see me, my delusive emotions of love and attachments were severed at once. On account of the power of these roots, these good roots, I could be born in the Torii heaven," which is one of those Buddhist realms. So this is a pretty shocking story for us. When we hear this, you know, how could someone do that? And we hear that quite often in these dialogues and these counters. So it's important, I feel, that when we do make a judgment about that we always consider, you know, our own well-being, and we're looking at our own worldview as far as these judgments are concerned. But when I was thinking about this and said, what example can I give here where we actually do the same thing, you know? So the one example came to mind is that a friend of mine, I think I may have mentioned that once before, a friend of mine has a son, and the son's a drug addict. And the son kept on coming back for money until he said, no, I won't give you any money, you know. And as a father, to see that his son was suffering, money was never the object, of course, but money was just furthering the suffering, you know. No matter what he did, you know, he could not get the son to stop taking the drugs, you know. In the end, he had to sever the relationship. You are no longer welcome unless you get rid of the drugs. You are no longer welcome, you know. And that was so hard for him to do, you know. And so this is a compassionate way of severing attachment, you know. So we are quite often told that and it's what it says in, it's what the mother realized, she severed attachment. We are quite often told we need to let go of attachment, you know. But where do you draw the line as far as attachment is concerned? How far do you go, you know? Monastics have a completely different take on this than us. We are lay people here. Most of us have got family, you know, and we've got our attachment, whether that is jobs, whether that is kids, whether that is whatever. Monastics, especially Buddhist monastics, and certainly the early Buddhist monastics as well, they severed all ties. What is also important to remember is that these teachings are not for your average person. We just think all of a sudden that Buddhism is for everyone. It's not. Buddhism was designed originally for a very, very specific cohort of people. They were called home leavers. It was specifically designed for that. It was never meant to be mindfulness that is now so broad. We now bring all these teachings in and question them in relation to our own circumstances. You know, Buddhism was never intentioned for that. It was designed for monastics, you know. The lay people were taught to make good merit. In other words, do good deeds, you know. Until they got to a stage where all of a sudden they were ready to hear this type of teachings. And not everyone is ready. So if you say this sort of thing, some of the stuff that we do and some of the, like even if you say the chair is a mandarin, I mean, that's ridiculous to be able to say. Of course you wouldn't say that in a normal day-to-day situation. It is specifically designed for those people that can hear that are ready to hear that, you know. And it's the same with this, you know, please keep that in mind. Okay. So, but anyway, there are still some other examples here, looking at this situation with the mother. And one of my examples is my own family. My sister became a missionary. She's joined a Catholic order. I remember when this happened, you know. My mother was horrified. Not horrified because she's a good Catholic, but all of a sudden it hit her. I am going to lose my daughter. It was really traumatic, you know. She thought that my sister was going to look after her in her old age and be always there. She was a favorite as well, the youngest, you know. It's like, oh my God, she's joined this strange order in Spain. First thing she did, she got on a bus and drove there and tried to drag her out of it, you know. My wife was actually there at the time because Diana was going to go with my sister traveling along Europe. I was on business somewhere else. This is in the early 80s. And my sister got to Spain, and my wife, Diana, got to Spain. And she said, are you ready to go? And she said, no, I made a decision. I'm going to stay. I'm going to join, you know. That was it. Just like that, you know. And of course, then she told my mother. My mother came over in the end. Diana and my mother did the trip, as it worked out. But it just shows you, even still today, that, you know, this severing is still taking place, you know. Now, of course, You know, when you look at the story here at face value, and that's all we can do, we take it at face value, you know. That is an absolute fixation. If you had your mother in front of your door begging to see you and you say, no, I'm not going to let you in because of an attachment, well, that is pretty dysfunctional. I mean, that is pretty severe. You would have to, you know, no matter what, you would have to say there is something really not right here, you know. Who could actually say that? But what it shows us is it shows us the absolute determination of Tozen. That is one thing it shows us. Like, man, to be able, who could do that? You know, like, it's incredible determination of Tozen. So that's one thing it shows us. But it also shows us, in my view, that when we look at things like attachment, and it's the same as the precepts, you know, if we take attachment literally or non-attachment literally, we can get into some really awful things. In the name of non-attachment, you can do that, you know. So we always have the compassionate side of it, you know. That has to be there, you know. When you look at the needs of others, compassion automatically arises, as I said in my first Teisho, you know. So we always need to look at from the compassionate side as well. Then there's the literate side. And the other side is the absolute side, if you can see the absolute side. There's actually no such thing as attachment. What we are attached to is actually attachment. We are not attached to anything else. We are attached to attachment. Once we let go of attachment, as attachment, we can be attached to anything. It's all free. There is no such thing. Nothing can bind us anymore. That's very powerful. But to get to that stage, we have to let go, you know. What do we let go of? Attachment. Then to what degree do we do it? To a point where we don't let our mother in? No. Into the room when she wants to see us? Of course not, you know. But we all have our own journey to do. And some of it may be, you know, some of it may be dysfunctional. Some of it may be wrong in hindsight, you know. And we have to live with that. But all of these experiences add to hopefully getting to a point where I see that my attachment is not to my mother. My attachment is to my own attachments. You know, that's the message that I got out of this. You know. So this is a very, very important story in that sense. And by the way, that's the same with love. Now, it says here, because the mother afterwards came to him in a dream and said, because you firmly preserved your resolve and did not see me, my delusive emotions of love and attachment were severed at once. You know, love is another attachment. Of course, to us, love is like supreme. How can you not love? And but of course, it can be really, really. It can also be really dysfunctional if we are attached to love to such a degree that we keep on giving money to our children so they can go and buy drugs. That can be very dysfunctional. You know, we need to sever that. Doesn't mean we love anymore, but you know, we need to be able to sever it and see it for what it is. You know, the attachment to the attachment that is the. Even the attachment to love is like, we can look at it that way. This is what I got out of this. Now, there's a lot more to go in this particular Teisho. We haven't even started on the Kaizen's Teisho yet, so I'll continue that tomorrow.